Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. You're singing our song. Well, the first thrill tonight was to find myself for the first time in a long time in a movie on prime time. But this, as you can imagine, is the second big thrill. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice President-to-be, this convention, my fellow citizens of this great nation, with a deep awareness of the responsibility conferred by your trust, I accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States. I do so with deep gratitude, and I think also I might interject on behalf of all of us our thanks to Detroit and the people of Michigan and of this city for the warm hospitality we have enjoyed. And I thank you for your wholehearted response to my recommendation with regard to George Bush as the candidate for Vice President. I'm very proud of our party tonight. This convention has shown to all America a party united with positive programs for solving the nation's problems, a party ready to build a new consensus with all those across the land who share a community of values embodied in these words: family, work, neighborhood, peace, and freedom. Now, I know that we've had a quarrel or two, but it only as to the method of attaining a goal. There was no argument here about the goal. As president, I will establish a liaison with the 50 governors to encourage them to eliminate, wherever it exists, discrimination against women. I will monitor federal laws to ensure their implementation and to add statutes if they are needed. More than anything else, I want my candidacy to unify our country, to renew the American spirit and sense of purpose. I want to carry our message to every American, regardless of party affiliation, who is a member of this community of shared values. Never before in our history have Americans been called upon to face three grave threats to our very existence, any one of which could destroy us. We face a disintegrating economy, a weakened defense, and an energy policy based on the sharing of scarcity. The major issue of this campaign is the direct political, personal, and moral responsibility of Democratic Party leadership in the White House and in the Congress for this unprecedented calamity which has befallen us. They tell us they've done the most that could humanly be done. They say that the United States has had its day in the sun, that our nation has passed its zenith. They expect you to tell your children that the American people no longer have the will to cope with their problems, that the future will be one of sacrifice and few opportunities. My fellow citizens, I utterly reject that view. As your nominee, I pledge to you to restore to the federal government the capacity to do the people's work without dominating their lives. I pledge to you... I pledge to you a government that will not only work well, but wisely. Its ability to act tempered by prudence, and its willingness to do good, balanced by the knowledge that government is never more dangerous than when our desire to have it help us blinds us to its great power to harm us. You know, the first Republican president once said, "While the people retain their virtue and their vigilance, no administration by any extreme of wickedness or folly can seriously injure the government in the short space of 4 years." If Mr. Lincoln could see what's happened in the last 3.5 years, he might hedge a little on that statement. But with the virtues that are our legacy as a free people, and with the vigilance that sustains liberty, we still have time to use our renewed compact to overcome the injuries that have been done to America these past 3.5 years. First, we must overcome something the present administration has cooked up, a new and altogether indigestible economic stew. One part inflation, one part high unemployment, one part recession, one part runaway taxes, one part deficit spending, seasoned with an energy crisis. It's an economic stew that has turned the national stomach. Make no mistake, we will not permit the safety of our people or our environmental heritage to be jeopardized. But we are going to reaffirm that the economic prosperity of our people is a fundamental part of our environment. Our problems are both acute and chronic. Yet all we hear from those in positions of leadership are the same tired proposals for more government tinkering, more meddling, and more control, all of which led us to this sorry state in the first place. Can anyone look at the record of this administration and say, well done? Can anyone compare the state of our economy when the Carter administration took office with where we are today and say, keep up the good work? Can anyone look at our reduced standing in the world today and say, let's have 4 more years of this? I believe the American people are going to answer these questions as you've answered them in the first week in November, and their answer will be, no, we've had enough. Thanks to the economic policies of the Democratic Party, millions of Americans find themselves out of work. Millions more have never even had a fair chance to learn new skills, hold a decent job, or secure for themselves and their families a share in the prosperity of this nation. It's time to put America back to work, to make our cities and towns resound with the confident voices of men and women of all races, nationalities, and faiths, bringing home to their families a paycheck they can cash for honest money. For those without skills, we'll find a way to help them get new skills. For those without job opportunities, we'll stimulate new opportunities, particularly in the inner cities where they live. For those who've abandoned hope, we'll restore hope and we'll welcome them into a great national crusade to make America great again. When we move from domestic affairs and cast our eyes abroad, we see an equally sorry chapter in the record of the present administration. A Soviet combat brigade trains in Cuba just 90 miles from our shores. A Soviet army of invasion occupies Afghanistan, further threatening our vital interests in the Middle East. America's defense strength is at its lowest ebb in a generation, while the Soviet Union is vastly outspending us in both strategic and conventional arms. Our European allies, looking nervously at the growing menace from the East, turn to us for leadership and fail to find it. And incredibly, more than 50, as you've been told from this platform so eloquently already, more than 50 of our fellow Americans have been held captive for over 8 months, by a dictatorial foreign power that holds us up to ridicule before the world. Adversaries, large and small, test our will and seek to confound our resolve. But we are given weakness when we need strength, vacillation when the times demand firmness. The Carter administration lives in a world of make-believe, every day drawing up a response to that day's troubles, regardless of what happened yesterday and what will happen tomorrow. But you and I live in a real world where disasters are overtaking our nation without any real response from Washington. This is make-believe, self-deceit, and above all, transparent hypocrisy. For example, Mr. Carter says he supports the volunteer army, but he lets military pay and benefits slip so low that many of our enlisted personnel are actually eligible for food stamps. Reenlistment rates drop. And just recently, after he fought all week against a proposed pay increase for our men and women in the military, he then helicoptered out to the carrier, the USS Nimitz, which was returning from long months of duty in the Indian Ocean, and told the crew of that ship that he advocated better pay for them and their comrades. Where does he really stand now that he's back on shore? Now this evening marks the last step, save one, of a campaign that has taken Nancy and me from one end of this great nation to the other over many months and thousands of miles. There are those who question the way we choose a president, who say that our process imposes difficult and exhausting burdens on those who seek the office. I have not found it so. It's impossible to capture in words the splendor of this vast continent which God has granted as our portion of his creation. There are no words to express the extraordinary strength and character of this breed of people we call American. Everywhere we've met thousands of Democrats, independents, and Republicans from all economic conditions, all walks of life, bound together in that community of shared values of family, work, neighborhood, peace, and freedom. They're concerned, yes. They're not frightened. They're disturbed, but not dismayed. They are the kind of men and women Tom Paine had in mind when he wrote during the darkest days of the American Revolution, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again." Nearly 150 years after Tom Paine wrote those words, an American president told the generation of the Great Depression that it had a rendezvous with destiny. I believe this generation of Americans today also has a rendezvous with destiny. Tonight, let us dedicate ourselves to renewing the American compact. I ask you not simply to trust me, but to trust your values, our values, and to hold me responsible for living up to them. I ask you to trust that American spirit, which knows no ethnic, religious, social, political, regional, or economic boundaries. The spirit that burned with zeal in the hearts of millions of immigrants from every corner of the earth who came here in search of freedom. Some say that spirit no longer exists. But I've seen it. I felt it all across this land, in the big cities, the small towns, and in rural America. It's still there, ready to blaze into life if you and I are willing to do what has to be done. And the time is now to redeem promises once made to the American people by another candidate in another time and another place. He said, "For 3 long years, I have been going up and down this country preaching that government, federal, state, and local, cost too much. I shall not stop that preaching. As an immediate program of action, we must abolish useless offices. We must eliminate unnecessary functions of government. We must consolidate subdivisions of government and, like the private citizen, give up luxuries which we can no longer afford." And then he said, "I propose to you, my friends, and through you, that government of all kinds, big and little, be made solvent, and that the example be set by the President of the United States and his cabinet." End of quote. That was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's words as he accepted the Democratic nomination for president in 1932. The time is now, my fellow Americans, to recapture our destiny, to take it into our own hands. And to do this, we'll take many of us working together. I ask you tonight, all over this land, to volunteer your help in this cause so that we can carry our message throughout the land. Isn't it time that we, the people, carry out those unkept promises that we pledged to each other and to all America on this July day, 48 years later, that now we intend to do just that? I have thought of something that's not a part of my speech and worried over whether I should do it. Can we doubt that only a divine providence placed this land, this island of freedom, here as a refuge for all those people in the world who yearn to breathe free? Jews and Christians enduring persecution behind the Iron Curtain, the boat people of Southeast Asia, of Cuba, and of Haiti, the victims of drought and famine in Africa, the freedom fighters in Afghanistan, and our own countrymen held in savage captivity. I'll confess that I've been a little afraid to suggest what I'm going to suggest. I'm more afraid not to. Can we begin our crusade? Join together in a moment of silent prayer. God bless America.